Before I start, I wanted to give a big shout out to Jeannie Colwin Coaching. Jeannie Colwin is a highly respected and heart-centered stress and TMS coach based in LA. After enduring 16 grueling years of chronic pain and illness, she healed herself completely and now is obsessed with guiding others in her signature one-on-one coaching program. With support, consistency, and accountability, clients learn to get out of pain and heal their symptoms for good. Now, Jeannie has something special just for you, a brand new free training. Start your journey with her 24-hour stress detox. It's a powerful mini course designed to give you a simple but effective reset. In less than 15 minutes, you'll gain evidence-based tools and step-by-step guidance to complete your own stress detox. Stress, as we often discuss on this show, is a major contributor to TMS symptoms that impact your well-being, your relationships, and your career. If you're sick of feeling this, then you deserve a detox. Are you ready to begin? Check out the show notes and sign up for immediate access. I'm going to put them down there, so be sure to check it out. Welcome back to the show. It is November the 14th. This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Eddie Lindenstein, and I come to you from a gloomy Pacific Northwest. We are in the full swing of things. It is 54 degrees, and the sun is going to set today at 4:35. So soccer season is wrapped up, and I think life is going to just start chilling a little bit. Zoe is going to be beginning basketball here in a couple of weeks, but we don't have a whole bunch of sporting events and things like that to do, meaning kids' sporting events and different engagements like that, until at least the first week of December. So we got a little bit of time now to just chill, watch some Kraken hockey, watch the rest of whatever this University of Washington Husky season is. I think their best chance at winning, at getting to their sixth win and thus making a bowl game, is this Friday night against UCLA. And I will be there with my wife, and I guess we'll just see how it goes. But because I don't think they're going to beat Oregon on the 30th. So all eyes point to this weekend. So let's just hope that we can get there. So this week, I wanted to revisit a killer interview. Now, this is part one of what I did with Dr. Strax. It's from about a year and a half ago. Time is such a amazing thing, because when I think back to interviews that I did, I'm always like, that was like 3 to 6 months ago. Same with the Dr. Strax thing. This is from July 26th of 2023, and it was recorded 2 weeks before that. So we're talking about very early summer, a year ago, so a year and a half ago, which is just kind of crazy to believe. Now, Dr. Strax is, I make a joke in here that me as Thanos of TMS people to interview, he was kind of like one of the final Infinity Stones, and finally captured him for this meeting. So I'm excited. For those of you that are newer to the show, this podcast has been listened to well over 500,000 times. Not the one with John Strax, but the one with this podcast in particular, the Mind and Fitness Podcast. I've been doing this for a long time. I think that the show hit 7 years a couple of weeks ago. So there is so much good stuff in the archives, and the goal moving forward with the show is, hey, let's bring a couple of new interviews to the forefront each month. I can do a solo show, and then let's bring back something that was really great from the archives. And that's what this Dr. Strax one is. So this was part one. This was episode 285 with Dr. Strax and I. I think that you're going to dig it. So let's check it out. Let's listen. So I often make the joke on this podcast that, I'm basically Thanos searching for the Infinity Stones of people that I can possibly interview. And there was kind of like one remaining medical doctor in the United States that I really, really wanted to talk to. And that person is here with me. Dr. John Strax out of Chicago is on the line. Can you hear me?
I can hear you great.
It's great to have you on here. Your name's been brought up numerous times by numerous people that I've interviewed over the years, which is awesome. Nicole Sachs is quite, she mentions you a lot, but you have a lot of raving fans out there if you didn't know. And so I'm excited to dive in and learn a little bit more about you.
That's great. I am excited to be here, and I'm a big fan of Nicole's, as you know, and yeah, this is great.
Okay. So are you in Chicago proper or a suburb?
So I live in the suburbs. My office is in Chicago proper, about 2 miles northwest of downtown Chicago.
Okay, cool. My corporate office for my day job is in Schaumburg, and that's as close as I've flown into O'Hare and all that stuff, and beautiful city. And I remember I brought up that it was like a Cubs game starting at 6 p.m. and I asked the corporate office, hey, if we get out today at 4 or 4:30, could I make it to Wrigley by 6? And they said, I don't know, like, you know, middle of the day on a Wednesday might be kind of tough. And, you know, I wanted to see the Home Alone house. I had all these aspirations. So you live in an awesome part of, except for the fact that it's very flat and there's not a hill in sight. I love that part of the country.
It's great. I've lived here mostly all my life and have practiced here since I finished residency 15 years ago. And I love Chicago, and people who are from the coasts, right, are like, Chicago, is that like, can you swim across the lake there? And so it's fun to have people who haven't been here come out here and realize what a great city it is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Where did you go to school?
I went to Yale University, graduated in 1991, so a long time ago. And then I took about 10 years off to find my way back to medical school. And so I started medical school at the University of Chicago right after September 11, like September of 2001, and then did 3 years of residency at the University of Michigan from 05 to 08. That's where I met Dr. Schubiner, and then finished that with a year in the integrative medicine clinic at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. Then moved back to Chicago at that point, 2009.
Awesome. Okay. I was going to ask about that because I saw some background with Michigan, and then I was thinking to myself, well, I mean, Dr. Schubiner is as Michigan gets. You can hear it in the way that he talks and he practices there and things like that. And what is up with this Midwest and the TMS doctors? Like, is there something in the water, I feel like?
I moved to Michigan to do residency in, like I said, in 2005. And I was looking for other people who practiced TMS because there was really just Dr. Sarno at that point. And between the time I matched in residency, which was March of 2005, and when I got there in June, Dr. Schubiner had opened his clinic. And so I called him, having no idea who he was, and said, I'm interested in doing this kind of work, and I see you are too. And he's a big deal. Like, he won't talk like this, but he did a residency in both internal medicine and pediatrics, so med peds residency together. And the top resident in med peds in the country now wins the Howard Schubiner Award.
Wow.
And so I called him up. I was like, hey, I'm just starting my internship at the University of Michigan. And he was so friggin' nice. And invited me out to his hospital to meet him. We talked, and he was just starting to teach some classes, and Unlearn Your Pain, which is his book, was a textbook that he had put together for these classes. So I spent a ton of time with him while I was in Michigan, just learning and watching and eventually starting to do some of my own work. But he was super helpful and, continues to be a colleague and a mentor, and now he's working for me too. So
That's an interesting description, because that was actually like the first thing that came to mind for me, is that when I'd sent him an email 4.5 years ago or something about interviewing him, and the response A was quick, but then two was just very cordial. And, in my mind, especially at the time, I had only been doing this for a year and a half or so, and I had thought, like, this guy's kind of a legend in this space, and he's well known, and he's got this best-selling book and all that, and he's just willing to jump on the phone with a guy that he has no idea who I am. And that was just really nice and refreshing, because and we'll talk about this a little bit, I'm sure, but part of my experience, I think a lot of the frustrating experience for people that kind of go through this TMS journey, weaving through doctors and physical therapists and chiropractors and all that stuff, is that they do kind of get jaded by the end, that they might wait 2 months to be able to see a particular doctor, not necessarily a TMS doctor, but a physiatrist or anybody really in the area. I know that was the experience for me. Wait 2 or 3 months to get an appointment, and then you get in there and you get 5 or 7 minutes and you get passed on to another referral, and then a month or two later. And my experience, and maybe there's something to this, my experience in talking to doctors that have a specialty in this discipline, that you guys seem like you're a different breed. You talk different, you act different, you're bedside manner, even though we're not at a bedside, but your bedside manner is very different. Is there something to that, or is that just a coincidence?
No, I don't think that's a coincidence. I think that people who are attracted to this kind of medicine think in a certain way. And so you're familiar with Dr. Sarno, right? Did you
Yep.
start with
Oh,
Dr. Sarno's
yeah, sorry, no.
practice?
Yep.
Yeah. And so, for a long time, he was the only one. And so when I first learned about this and had my own health issues, that was in 1999. And there was a Dr. Sarno in New York and Dr. Schechter in Los Angeles was just getting started and actually used his workbook, but those were the only options. And so when I decided to go back to med school, which was around that same time, and got better, I started calling Dr. Sarno. I was like, "Hey, can I come out and watch you?" And for years he would push me off. He'd be like, "You're young, you don't even know what you're gonna do with your life. Call me when you figure it out." But I kept badgering him. And finally, like sometime in, must have been 2006, maybe, I called him and he said, "Fine, be out here on Tuesday." And so I flew out to New York and I spent a few days with him. And that was the big thing I noticed, right? I mean, he was a physical medicine and rehabilitation physician. Like that's what he did, but he really thought like a psychologist and he paid attention to what was going on in people's lives and who they were, and he was insightful that way. And so I think those of us in the field also are a little bit of that hybrid or even cross-trained where we have experience in medicine and trained as medical doctors, but a lot of us are attracted to the psychological side too. And I actually have done a fair amount of psychology training too and somatic psychotherapy. And so a lot of experiences in my own life that make me want to spend time with people and want to listen to their story and want to empathize with what's going on in their lives. Whereas I think a lot of other people will go into medicine not for those reasons. They like the science or they like the structure of it, or some of my colleagues like the 4-minute appointments where they know what their job is to sort of get the assessment and give the prescription and let people go out the door. But that never worked for me. Like I was
Yeah.
never going to do that kind of medicine and was always interested in who people were and what had happened in their lives.
And maybe this isn't the perfect description, but the way that you said that, to me, it rings a lot of like the science versus art thing, where you have kind of a formulaic recipe of medicine, which is, like you had said, going in, making the diagnosis, prescribing the right things, that kind of thing. That's more of like the science side of it, but the less formulaic, which is a little bit more of an art, in my opinion, sounds like it's more of what you're describing.
And I think, as I think back, even back then, the year 2000, when I was applying to medical schools, that's what my personal statement was about, that I wanted to enter this because I liked the science and I liked the precision of it, but I'm also an artist
Yeah.
and was really looking to blend those two together and feel like this has been a pathway that's allowed me to do that.
What's so we talked a little bit before I had pressed the record button that my background is similar to yours in the sense of like diagnostics, which I thought was really interesting. It was one of those things where I think it was I woke up at I've been as people are listening to this, we're a couple weeks removed because this won't air probably until after the 4th of July. But I've been overly obsessed with this submarine story, as a lot of people are in the country right now. And some of it has to do with the fact that the headquarters where they built this thing is 7 miles from my house. So it's like, I mean, it's like right here. But then I was like, okay, I'm going to do some more research for the interview I'm doing in a few hours. This was at 5 in the morning or something this morning. And that's when I found the thoracic outlet syndrome part of it. I find it interesting isn't the right word because I think that it makes a lot of sense. But a lot of the doctors that I've interviewed on here, they obviously didn't go, they didn't, when they first went to medical school or started looking into becoming a doctor, the plan wasn't, I'm going to do mind body medicine. It was in something else, and for different reasons or whatever. And then they have this interesting shift in what, in their health, their own health, and this sort of propels them into kind of a new sector. So let's go back to Dr. Strax before he was Dr. Strax, and you were just John or Johnny or whatever, and you were wanting to become a doctor. Tell us a little bit about that. Like, what made you kind of even want to get into medicine to begin with?
So I had a pretty roundabout way of getting there. So I graduated from college in 1991 and didn't start medical school for another 10 years, 2001. And I left college, went to college in the East and came back to Chicago and started working at a youth center on the northwest side of the city, actually not far from where my office is now. And I was running drug prevention programs. So I would go into schools and run after school groups and weekend retreats for kids who lived in inner city Chicago. And then after a couple of years, I moved into child welfare and I was working with children who were state wards and were trying to figure out how to live on their own. I was a case manager. And after about 6 years, I kind of hit a wall that a lot of people in that field hit, where I realized, okay, I can't quite do this for the rest of my life, but what am I going to do instead? So I tried out a couple different pathways. I thought about getting into social service administration and thought I'd go get an MBA and try to use it for not-for-profit management. But none of those took, and I'd had in the back of my mind the possibility of med school for a while then. And so I wasn't sure, and so I went to Northwestern University here in Chicago. They have a night program, and I took a class on human physiology with the goal of either loving it and saying, okay, like, this is what I want to do, or hating it and going on to whatever was next on that list. And the class was meh. Like, it was all right. Like, yeah. It wasn't terrible, but it didn't compel me to do that. And so I took another class the next year in biology and sort of slowly wended my way back to school. But that process took 5 years also. And so it was a very gradual process as it came into focus. And I think, you know, the fact that I had been involved in the social work world and as I said, you know, like listening to people and like listening to their stories, that was compelling to me about the medical side, in addition to always liking science. I was always a science and math kid growing up. And so it ended up feeling like a good match. But then I got, you know, I had this episode in 1998, 1999, where I had these symptoms and nobody could figure it out. And nobody knew what to do. And it wasn't until I reread Dr. Sarno's book in the spring of 1999 that I was able to say, like, oh, okay, I get it. Too much going on in my life all at once. And so it's coming out in my body. And by that point, I was pretty sold on medical school, but now wanted to practice. So unlike a lot of physicians who are in this work, I knew before I got to school. And then when I got to school, I started telling everybody, like, hey, I understand pain. Let me tell you about what works. And people looked at me like I had 11 heads. Like, it was, yeah. They're like, what are you talking about? And so I needed to get further on in my training and have a little bit more authority and be able to talk about this in a little bit more coherent way before people started listening, before it started being helpful for people. So that's how I got into medicine and wanted to go this direction ever since I got there.
So that really is a much more divergent path than any of the doctors I've had on, because usually, and well, all the time, at least I can't recall. And again, this is, as we record this, this is like episode 290 or something. So there's been a lot that are in the can to try and remember, but I don't recall having anybody that, other than maybe psychotherapists, that learned about this stuff and then went to school and kind of went through that whole path. This is totally different. So how, you know, you learn about these things in the spring of 99, and then you're going through med school, and is there, do you have this kind of, to take something from the psychology verbiage world, did you have any cognitive dissonance as you're going through training about, you're learning this medical model, which in a lot of ways to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, and I'd love to be wrong here because I'd love a good explanation on this. Do you have this conflict between you're learning about everything is in this medical model versus there is a mind-body influence? Like, because this is a different time. Like now, and maybe it's because I'm looking for it, it seems like there's far more speech around biopsychosocial than there would have been 20 years ago. And so talk about having this knowledge in your mind and your own life experience as you're going through the training in another continuum or another, you know, another world.
So I had a few advantages. The biggest one, I think, is that I was 31 years old at the time and had been out in the world and had my own experiences. And so I was much more resistant to the push of the medical system into that purely biomedical model. And so that, I think, was the biggest advantage that I had. I went to the University of Chicago Medical School, which is, you know, it's a pretty scientifically based place. The dean at the time, Larry Wood, was actually quite holistic. And so I got to know him a little bit. He left after my second year, but got to know him a little bit, and he encouraged me to follow that pathway if I was interested in it. John Cacioppo, a name you probably don't know, he passed away a couple of years ago, but he's a psychologist who literally wrote the book on loneliness. If you search loneliness, you'll find out that he wrote it. And he was doing a lot of research into the physiology of psychological conditions. And so I got to do some research with him when in between my first and second year, and got to know him a little bit. And so there were people, even though I was in the midst of this biomedical system, there were people who actually encouraged me to follow my passion in this direction. And despite all that, they almost beat it out of me. And so the way medical school works, the first 2 years are basic science, and then you get into the hospital wards, and you rotate through surgery, and you rotate through pediatrics, and internal medicine, and OBGYN. And by the end of my third year, I had a day where I was like, I think I'm just going to go be a cardiologist, like everybody else here is going to be a cardiologist. And then again, I signed up for an elective at the beginning of my fourth year in integrative medicine. And there was a clinic that had just opened in the Chicago area. And one of the physicians had been trained by Andrew Weil, just the holistic physician with the big beard.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep. The breath guy. That's what I call him.
Yep. And yes, exactly. And so I got to spend a month in that clinic, and I would like ride my bike to the train and take a train and then walk through the meadow to the clinic. And it was just so delightful. And I remembered what I liked and what I really liked to do. And around that time, there were family medicine residencies that were starting to partner with some integrative medicine physicians. And so I ended up targeting those for when I applied to residency programs. And so somebody had trained in Arizona with Dr. Weil and moved to Ann Arbor and set up this program. And that's where I matched into. And so yes, the system tried to push me this way and that way, but I think having met a number of people along the way who encouraged me to stay the course, and I think, like I said, just having had that life experience before getting into school helped me to keep focused on what I liked rather than sort of getting in line with the biomedical side that is so prevalent in the medical education system.
How have you seen, I've told this story a few times, but I started doing this in 2017, and a couple of years later, it might've been 2019 or so, maybe 2020. Cause again, to me, this seems very, what's the word I'm looking for? Okay, here's a good example. I was interviewed on a live cast for this fairly well-known CrossFit worldwide community not too long ago. And a listener of this podcast sent me a message to say, hey, your explanation of TMS was one of the most succinct and better ones that I've heard. I was very nonchalant about it. And it was like, I didn't get into the weeds. It was like my 40-second elevator speech, maybe. Because to me, people that are on the peripheral, they might think that I'm crazy. You said like 11 heads or whatever this statement was earlier. So I don't talk about it all that much with people that don't have a knowledge of it because of ridicule or just because of disbelief or, you know, whatever it may be. But I remember seeing during an NFL commercial spot, I think it was Cigna Healthcare, did a commercial a couple of years ago about basically mind-body health. I mean, that's totally kind of what it was. That was the first time I saw anything on a national scale that was about that. So how have you really seen this sort of evolve into kind of the, not just the collective conscious over the last 10 or 15 years, but even just like in, you know, you have lots of colleagues that don't practice what you practice, and they probably don't believe everything you believe. How have you seen this evolve in the last 15 or 20 years?
So, like I said, when I was first learning about it, so it was 1999, it was just Dr. Sarno and Dr. Schechter, and I don't think there was anybody else around. And then, so I moved to Michigan. I worked a lot with Dr. Schubiner. And that fellowship year, that fourth year I spent in Ann Arbor, he and I decided to invite everybody we could who knew about this kind of work to Ann Arbor for the day to talk about it and have a conference. And like 30 people showed up. It was amazing. And, you know, probably equal numbers we talked to and didn't show up. Dr. Sarno teleported in and talked with people. It was great. And so that's kind of where we were. You know, at that point, Dr. Sarno had probably sold, you know, hundreds of thousands of books that people have read, and a lot of people have gotten better just by reading his books over the years. But that's not that many people. And there are, you know, whatever, 125 million Americans who are in chronic pain. And so, you know, over that next 15 years now, my friends at Curable, I don't know if you've interviewed John Gribben, who's CEO at Curable, which is one of the apps that works on this and that I was involved with as a medical advisor from the beginning, but they've been downloaded over 1 million times. And so we've clearly ramped up the number of people who have access to this information, both in the United States and around the world. Similarly, Curable has a Facebook group for physicians who are interested, and there are, you know, thousands of people who have signed up for it. And that compares to the 30 people that we found in 2009. And so while I get frustrated every now and then, because some of the work that I have done in the non-TMS world has sort of grown exponentially, some of the endocrinology work that I do and others. And this, I think, has been linear growth over time, but it's still been substantial growth. And so if I talk even with a group of conventional physicians, nobody argues with me anymore about whether stress and symptoms are related. Every physician knows that. I think the problem is that a lot of physicians don't know how to talk about it. Sure. And then the system that only gives them 2 or 3 minutes with any given patient. But I definitely think that this idea that mind and body are connected, for the most part, people understand that. Even if they don't know how to use it, people understand it. So we're not arguing so much about that anymore, which is really nice. And so then the next step is to figure out how people, both on the physician side and the patient side, can enter into the space more easily so that it doesn't take so long to find it and that people can get quicker, can get better more quickly once they find out about it.
Do you think the reason for that is it now taught in medical schools, or taught, like, where, what would you attribute that to?
Mm-hmm. I don't know that I think it's taught particularly well in medical schools. I mean, when I was working at the university, at Northwestern University here in Chicago, I got an hour a year to talk to people about this. And so they heard it, right? And some of the students would react positively and want to know more, and others would be on the back in their laptop, like trying to figure out the, you know, new suture technique that they were going to learn in their surgical rotation. But I think that as a society, we're just more aware. And, you know, when you think about generations and what they know, each time we go down a generation, I find that people are more open to these ideas. And so talk to my millennial patients and my Generation Z patients. The Generation Z patients, like, this is their language. Yeah. They talk about psychology. They talk about mental health. They all know people who struggle with it. They all know what that means. And so I just think that the language of integrated health is becoming easier to use as we go further along.
Makes me wonder, what if you and I were having this conversation in 30 years, mm-hmm. how different could that be?
I agree. Years? And, you know, I got to medical school late, and so I've been practicing 15 years. So I may still be around practicing 30 years.
From now. Well, I hope so. I hope so.
Again. And I agree. Like, I, you know, there are a lot of people out there who intend to push this forward. And a lot of us are working on, how do we spread the word? How do we make it easier to access? How do we make it better? How do we help people not struggle to, like I said, to find out about this? And then what's the quickest pathway towards feeling better is an issue I think that a lot of us think about a lot. And the more effective we can be, the more people are going to hear about it and want to learn more.
I'm fairly involved in various, like, online TMS communities, whether it's Facebook groups or the TMS Wiki, things like that. And I have seen from time to time over the last couple of years, it's almost like two schools of thought. It's like Sarno has this, or had this, oxygen debt theory. And that was kind of what rang throughout his books. And let me make this very clear that I'm not throwing shade on anybody's opinion, because to me, when I read varying opinions on this, like, they all sort of arrive at the same place. And so I don't know if it really even matters. So Sarno kind of has the oxygen debt thing. And then in, like, Schubiner's books, for instance, he's talking more a he doesn't say nervous system dysregulation, but that's kind of what, and to me, I'm kind of like, well, there's, they might sort of be the same thing. And if you have the same symptoms, who really cares? So now that, you know, you've been in this field for a long time and the science has evolved on it, now there's actually been published studies that have been done, like the Boulder back pain study and such. Like, what's some of the evolution from that book that you read in 1999 that have maybe changed, or new things that we've learned, like some of the more pertinent or larger things that come to mind if I ask you a question like that?
Yeah. And so, you know, a couple of thoughts there. Number one, we also have, the clinicians have a private email list that has been going on for as long as I can remember too. And a few years ago, there was a big argument about oxygen deprivation, and people got really heated. And I was like, this is great. We are now big enough to have a schism.
Yeah.
And so, right. So that's another sign of advancement. And I come down on the nervous system side, not the oxygen deprivation side. I think, you know, Dr. Sarno, my opinion, was a genius. Like, he understood this in ways that people did not back then. And yet I think there was a lot that he didn't have access to in terms of the science and the research. And so I think the research is clear that this is a nervous system issue, and that's how the pain gets produced. And what I teach even more so is that the pain comes from the brain. It's not that the brain is recognizing, the brain's actually creating it as an appropriate response to a potentially dangerous situation. And I think there are a lot of people in the field who like that particular scientific explanation. Makes a lot of sense to us. Makes it, I think, easier to teach, and in some ways easier for people to understand. And so I think that all has evolved since I first got, you know, first became aware of these ideas 20 years ago. I also think that, you know, there's been a lot of attention to what really makes people better. And so when I first learned about it in 1999, it was, you know, learn about this and then journal write. And that's what people did. And that's what Dr. Sarno said to do. And Dr. Schechter has his Mind Body Workbook, which, you know, thousands and thousands of people have used effectively. But one of the things that I have tried to do as a physician and as a clinician is to think, okay, now some people who can read a book and get better, that's more or less what I did. There's some people who can read a book and who can write some things out and let out some emotions and get better. But there are people who still struggle with that. And so I keep trying to dig down and think, all right, for the people who aren't getting better, what's next for them? And for then once they're better, what's next for the people who aren't getting better? And I think, you know, there's been a lot written about the experience of trauma over the last decade and how that gets into people's body, and Bessel van der Kolk's book, The Body Keeps the Score. And so, you know, in the last 5 years, we've hired a number of psychologists to work with us, because there are times where just the people's experience is complex enough that working with a mental health professional is really useful in trying to work this out and figure out how to feel better in their own bodies.